All right, beautiful, beautiful. So some reflections here. And first off, just a little straw poll. How many folks have seen Everything Everywhere All at Once? And how many folks have not? Kind of a mix there, right on. All right, so I'm not gonna talk about the plot a ton, so I'll try not to do a lot of spoilers, but I'll mention it a little bit. And you know, bias alert, I just adored the film, so this is partly a, you know, an homage to it, and the writing that I did today was part of that as well. It's a film that came out last year by the directing team called the Daniels, Daniel Scheiner and Daniel Kwan. And stars Michelle Yeoh, co-stars Kei-Hui Kwan, who has just a really poignant life story, both of them reflecting on anti-Asian bias and the triumph of standing on the Oscar stage on Sunday night. Part of what I loved about the film, besides that I've loved Michelle Yeoh as a action hero and goddess and all around extraordinary human since my days of obsessing about Hong Kong New Wave and Kung Fu films in the mid 1990s, besides all of that, really the sense that it's a beautiful Dharma film, and I want to reflect on just a few themes in it. The plot is impossible to summarize, so I'll just say that it centers around an immigrant family, Chinese family, running a laundromat. It's the day of the New Year's Day party. The laundromat is kind of chaotic, difficult to run. The owner of the laundromat, Evelyn, is behind on her taxes, super stressed, falling apart. Her marriage is falling apart. Her daughter is estranged. Her daughter is also queer. Her elderly father is coming to visit. She can't figure out how to say to her extremely judgmental elderly Chinese father that her daughter is gay. But her girlfriend Becky is coming over, and everybody's complaining, and she's going to pieces, and she has to go to the IRS building to confront an auditor for her taxes, which are a total mess. And the auditor is played by Jamie Lee Curtis, who becomes the most frightening, monstrous IRS auditor you ever heard of. And the plot unfolds simultaneously as a working class immigrant narrative, a queer erasure and visibility and narrative, a mother-daughter healing arc, a romantic movie between husband and wife who are having a hard time, but somewhere in the middle of the movie also turn into an opera singer and a billionaire in an homage to Wong Kar-wai's extraordinary film In the Mood for Love. And shortly enough, Evelyn, the protagonist, is informed that she somehow has to save the entire universe and all the parallel multi-universes, of which there's an infinite number, from a monstrous figure who has figured out how to simultaneously understand everything happening in every universe all at once, and has become omnipotent and omniscient because of it, and has pulled all the force of everything that ever existed into one totem object, which is a burnt black everything bagel that has become the signature totem object of her cult, of which she's the leader, that is a pure nihilistic cult. And the core of their message is that because everything exists in infinitely varied microscopic iterations, that nothing means anything. So it's fundamentally a, her and the big evil one is revealed to be a variation of Evelyn's daughter Joy. And so the so a mother-daughter estrangement plot mixed with queer coming out and ancestral trauma is blenderized into a Save the Multiverse sci-fi plot with a nihilistic religion, people who can connect with parallel versions of themselves in parallel universes and acquire their skills. So Evelyn learns to do this and becomes a kung fu master and a lot of other things. And the whole thing goes through the kind of exploding all realities arc that you might expect it to, and then reforms at the end. So that's all I'm going to say about the plot. Maybe that's enough. If you haven't seen it, that might mean nothing to you, but go see it or not, as you like. What the film does, in part, is it proposes something that's philosophically really precise. It proposes that awareness of infinity and the infinite possibilities, that seeing the universe in that way, can't help but break down the solidity of your sense of your own narrative. We feel like our narrative is one thing. I've got this lifetime, I'm tracking these relationships, these ambitions, these processes. When you, if you could see, you know, in the infinite number of parallel universes, that every microscopic choice you've ever made, and every microscopic choice that any being in all the universes has ever made, has splintered off into another universe. You know, there's another universe where I didn't drop out of a doctorate in music and I kept on going with classical music. And there's another universe where, you know, I didn't break up with that person and we kept on going and did something else. And there was another universe where I didn't stub my toe on the stairs a month and a half ago and break my pinky and it still hurts. In that universe, it doesn't hurt because I didn't do that. But down to the microscopic differences. And so this is partly a movie about karma, right? Choices that have consequences. And what happens if you understand how karma works, and that every possibility in a certain way carries in a you know, in a cosmic sense, kind of equal meaning or equal weight. Right? I might have not stubbed my toe, but I happened to, or I did for various conditions, you know. And in the Buddhist tradition, this is a really venerable reflection. It's a reflection said to lead to freedom. And it goes a little bit like this. And this is partly taken from the early Mahayana school called the Yogacara school, sometimes called the mind-only school. Chittamatra. And they would do an exercise where, similar to what we meditated on for emptiness, where they would say, choose something, anything, and begin to name the conditions that had to be present for this thing to come into existence. And, you know, and you could choose anything, really. You know, you could choose an experience, like there's a little ache in my hip. You could choose an object. Here's my phone, or there's the, you know, there's a guitar on the wall. What are the conditions that create this moment's experience of that guitar? Right? I could tell you some narrative. That was my mother's guitar. It's a mid-20th century, inexpensive Spanish-made parlor guitar. I could talk about the music of Spain. I could talk about flamenco. I could talk about the racial experience of Spain. I could talk about my mother and her musical desires. She never really played. She wanted to. She was self-conscious. It was kind of a desire object for her, but she barely played it. I could talk about the wood making it. I could talk about forests. I could talk about deforestation and, carbon sequestration and, and the descending chord progression 1, 7, 6, 5. And you could go on forever, right? And any one of you could go on forever. You could say, oh, I see the guitar. I make a connection to guitars. I'm thinking about this and music and wood and air and desire and love and flamenco dancers. And it goes on forever. That going on forever is emptiness. The guitar is empty of an intrinsic nature, because an intrinsic nature would take one of those aspects of the experience that we call guitar, and it would solidify it in a kind of permanent individual thing. Even to say, oh, the name guitar, this is the Platonic attempt to solve this problem. The name guitar, the idea guitar, names something ineffable, something intrinsic about that thing. And without that, it's not what it is. But what is the name guitar? There's a lot of things called a guitar, right? How much relationship does that thing have to the thing played heroically by Yngwie Malmsteen in 1978, or the thing played by Paco de Lucía, or the thing played by, a Colombian hill tribe person at a protest against an oil refinery? Like, what does guitar mean? It doesn't define the number of strings. It doesn't define the shape. What does it mean? And so it turns out that every layer of narrative that we associate with any experience is only one of essentially an infinite number of narratives. Everything has its name, but everything has multiple names, and everything means something different to everyone. All of us in this room could tell a different story about anything, and none of the stories would overlap perfectly. They would all, be a different facet of the thing. So then what is the thing? What is that thing? And if it's true for the guitar, it's true for the body. It's true for the earth. It's true for the felt sense of being a singular being. Here I am, I'm Sean, I've got this life, I've got this, all of these markers. I've got my race, class, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera markers. I've got my story, my place. Part of why this is a Dharma reflection, this multiverse thing, is that I want to make a proposal parallel. The multiverse idea, which is a kind of modern scientific idea, there's some mythical basis to it. It's an idea that in the present moment, there's an infinite proliferation of variations of this life, say, at the same time. So we call them different universes, as if they're distributed in space somehow. What that really means, it doesn't really mean material space, as if a universe is a bounded bubble. We can't find any edge to our universe. That's, there's some idea that we could say, oh, we can guess from the velocity of galaxies that maybe it goes out this far, but then what's past that? Is there a border on the other side of which there's another universe? It doesn't make sense. Therefore, the multiverse is more like a conceptual mind blower that says that in the same way that in a quantum system, you fire a photon through a pair of slits in a card, and sometimes it goes through one and sometimes it goes through the other, there's a probability that it'll go through one or the other. And that's the only thing you can measure, is the probability, and you see where it goes. And the strange, mysteriousness of those systems, that the multiverse is really a collection of probabilities, right? There's this much probability that in February I didn't stub my toe, or that my mother actually played the guitar rather than looking at it longingly and having a ego dystonic experience, suffused with desire and failure, and how that got passed to me and all the things. And so you can think of the multiverse as, infinite iterations of myself and all of existence strung out in kind of simultaneous space. The Buddha flips that. He has the same experience, but strung out in time. So I'm going to propose that the insight into rebirth, past births, is a kind of multiverse stretched out along the time spectrum rather than the space field. It has the same core intuition, which is that the experience that I have of being a self has happened, or is happening in a kind of timeless present and way that I can access countless numbers of times. We've been talking about this for the last couple of months, and in all those endless lives, births, universes, our myself and the identities of those I interact with have been in relationship with each other in an infinitely recombining sort of way. So in one of the texts that we're reading over in the Spirit Rock Sutta study class we read last week, Samyutta Nikaya 15, it says that the universe, samsara, the endless round of births, has been going on for uncountable eons. Such a vast length of time, it's almost impossible to conceive. He gives some similes for how long that might be. And then says, because of this, it's impossible to find a being who has not been in the infinite round of recombining births, your mother, your father, your sister, your brother, your child, your friend, your partner, your lover, your enemy. In all the infinite rounds of being, animals and spirits and humans and gods and beings in different places, in different realms, time is so vast, or the conceptual field of return is so vast, that we must all have been everything to each other at some point. This is part of what the multiverse image points to. Part of what's so poignant about this film is that it lets the protagonist family, Evelyn, her husband Waymond, their daughter Joy, Grandpa Gong Gong, and the IRS agent Deirdre, lets them experience their lives in a variety of ways in contact with each other. One of the parallel universes that Evelyn goes to, so remember, right, her marriage is struggling. She's super stressed out. She's lost connection with her husband. At the beginning of the film, he's carrying around divorce papers. He's about to ask her for a divorce, but then everything gets super trippy and crazy, and he doesn't end up doing it. But he carries the papers around for the whole movie, and somewhere in the middle of the movie, she flips into an alternate universe where she's a movie star, like real life Michelle Yeoh. She's an action movie star, or an opera singer. Both of those show up, and in the opera singer one, she's glamorous and wealthy and beloved and not married to Waymond, and she comes back from her first visit to it, and there he is, and he's like, we have to do these things. And she says, I just saw my entire life without you. It was glorious. And at a later point, they flip back into it, and he's a billionaire, and they're kind of breaking up, or they're recognizing that they're not going to be together. And They're doing the whole thing, like they're impeccably dressed. It's like, Hong Kong or Shanghai in the like 19, 50s, maybe 40s, 50s. And in a rainy alleyway, and they're doing like perfect Wong Kar-wai. And it's this gorgeous new wave scene. And they just embody this whole different thing. Oh, this would have been that life. They talk about what their life would have been. But they're not going to be together. And he says at one point, he says, I would have done it. I would have spent my life doing taxes and laundry with you. And then they snap back to where they're doing taxes and laundry, in another parallel universe, he gets killed almost instantly. And she's like, oh no. And he says, don't worry about it. This is just a burner universe we're using for communication, and then evil hands reach through the wall, break his neck, he dies. And then she snaps into another universe. Like, I don't think we reckon with how trippy the Buddha's insight into past births must have been. That what he sees is this thing that he identifies as himself, but that has happened countless gazillions of times, not just a few iconic, Jungian metaphorical rebirths that are sort of psychologically resonant in the present. I was a soldier. I was a, I was a lover. Oh, I was your enemy, and then before that, I was your kid. And the Buddha tells the stories of some of these in the Jataka tales, and it's always the people around him that are in it. He says, oh, in this story, I could tell one. I said, oh, in this past story, I was a cafe chef in Morocco, and Jason was the owner of the cafe, and Nicole was the millionaire down the street who bought the cafe, out from under Jason when it was failing, and Andrea was my 2-year-old son who ran out into traffic, and Kylie was the newspaper delivering bicyclist who scooped baby Andrea up out of traffic, but then they got lost and they ended up at an orphanage run by Malky, who actually collected homing pigeons, and Nicholas and Caitlin were a bonded couple of homing pigeons who lived in the pigeon roost on top of the cafe. Like that's what the Buddha does in the Jataka tales. He says, well, in that tale, Sariputta was the advisor and I was the king, and I was the head goose. I was the fast goose, and Ananda was the duck, and et cetera. So the Buddha does that. There's some personalness to the rebirths, and that's the part that kind of resonates with us. I think that's why those are famous stories. But there's also the way that he goes way beyond that, right? He says, I saw 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 100, 1,000 births, but then, 100,000 births, a cosmic eon expanding and contracting, 1,000 cosmic eons expanding and contracting. That's like saying, I saw, I would, that's like saying I've been present not only for the entire history of life on Earth, but the entire history of life on other planets. And then for the entire arising of this universe from the Big Bang. And before that, another universe arising and passing with its own Buddhas and its own everything. And you start to get the kind of infinite multiverse kind of feeling. What do we make of that insight? That the thing that I call myself and the thing that I call each of you and all of our distinct experiences have been like fractaling around each other forever in every different recombination. The implication of that is emptiness, right? That this role in this very moment, teacher, student, Dharma practitioner, friend, straight person, queer person, like all of those roles, people, under patriarchy, people working for justice, people who who fall in love, people who are practicing the Dharma. The Dharma is empty. All of those things are marked by emptiness because their meaning is unfixed. Their identity is unfixed, always open, right? Always conditioned. At the heart of the movie, the villain, until she's no longer a villain, but the villain has constructed the nihilistic everything bagel into which everything flows. It's like a black hole of meaning, and nothing means anything. Nihilism is really the antagonist in this film. And it's really a teenage, or a kind of early 20-something, nihilism. It's the nihilism a daughter who's been rejected by her mother and her grandfather and doesn't really know how to be herself in the world, in a world of overstimulation, overinformation. And so this is the spoiler part. But don't worry, it won't ruin the movie for you. The villain is the daughter, and she's about to go off the brink, really into nihilism, really departing from the love or the bond of real relationship with her family. And her mother realizes this and realizes that the whole plot to destroy her was actually being run by the grandfather. And it was all wrong, and her role now is to regain connection, to save her daughter from nihilism, and so the thing that Evelyn realizes, that Joy, the daughter who becomes the evil Jobutpaki, the nihilist cult leader. The thing that the nihilist leader doesn't realize is she gets the insight into emptiness, but she doesn't understand that emptiness is always unified with compassion in the Dharma. She doesn't understand that the implication of everything being radically empty is that people are suffering because they don't know what's real, because they're lost in narratives, lost in grasping, lost in attachment. And without compassion, nihilism is the natural response to the infinite. You contact the infinite. Without compassion, everything is meaningless. Everything is just flickering, impermanent, just another lifetime of endless recombination. How would I orient myself in the world if that's all I saw? That's the juvenile vision of emptiness. And this is why that's spiritual bypass, right? That's why bypass is fundamentally a kind of immature spiritual gesture. You've seen something, you've seen that everything is contingent. But what you haven't done is completed the circle and come back to see those that you're in relationship with. And so compassion is the relational side. Right, of practice. Compassion, the expression of loving kindness or metta when it encounters suffering. And that's why in the Mahayana system, compassion is the focus rather than loving kindness, because emptiness is the focus. See emptiness from the mature heart, you naturally return with compassion. And so in the Mahayana systems, this is called the union or the unity of emptiness and compassion. So what Evelyn realizes, she attains the same insight into emptiness that Joy had touched into. She sees and acquires the power of all the multiverses. But she is bound to the world of meaning by relationship. She says, that's all of that's true, and I'm holding on to you, right? And the argument is like, that's meaningless. And the answer is like, that's okay, I'm holding on to you. And so this becomes You know, the Evelyn really becomes a bodhisattva. This is bodhisattva action. Bodhisattvas see emptiness, they understand emptiness. Bodhisattvas save beings, the Diamond Sutra says, by realizing that there's no such thing as beings to be saved. The bodhisattva who gives rise to the perception of suffering beings is not a bodhisattva. So you have to see emptiness in order to manifest the vast being-saving quality that is bodhisattva action. But the thing that bodhisattvas do is they never forget compassion. They see suffering beings, even though they don't give rise to the perception of separate suffering beings. That paradox is the unity of emptiness and compassion. And so, in practice, what we attend to really is we look for the places where our narratives, our fixated identities, our concepts that feel so solid, we look for the places where those are shaky, where we can see through them. We deconstruct a little bit. Oh, patriarchy, it feels so solid. But, I could go historical, I could go, communal, I could look around, I could go emotional, and I can find the cracks in it. I can find the places where it's falling apart or weak or was never really in charge. Or, you can see through authority in that way. You can see through the structures. Sometimes you get just a tiny glimpse, but that's how you see that they're empty. Seeing that they're empty, you return to those who can't see that they're empty, and the return is with compassion. So you say, "Oh, now I'm actually in contact with suffering. I understand how this works." Seeing emptiness relieves you. Your own heart from the clench of believing the narrative. And then compassion is the relational return. The Buddha almost didn't return. He said, "The thing I've seen is too subtle, no one will get it." Brahmasahunkuti appeared from the heaven realm and said, "Blessed one, you're wrong. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are perishing from not seeing, hearing the Dhamma. Teach and people will understand." And the Buddha looked around and said, "That's true. There are beings who will understand." So this is, he encountered emptiness in the vision of the infinite births and understood karma, understood how it works. And then he returned, as the Zen ox herding pictures end with returning to the marketplace with bliss bestowing hands. In the final fight scene, Evelyn has come back from the black hole of nihilism, from the everything bagel, that is the end, and she's defeating the final soldiers of the cult bad guy. And what she does is, each fighter she encounters, she connects with their deepest trauma and understands what they need, and she heals. Her hands come in this amazing kung fu move, and she's like, "Let me reset that shoulder that's been hurting for, years." She resets it, and the person's like, "Oh, thank you." And someone else, she comes in with the emotional, like, "That person has forgiven you. Forgive yourself." And the person's like, "Ah," oh, starts weeping. And she just goes through with the kung fu of healing, and she just, sets everyone's ailments. And this is what in the Mahayana would be called skillful means. She brings skillful means to each individual, because there's no one to fight anymore. Once you see that everything is empty, all the contention falls away, and all that's left is healing action, is bodhisattva action.